I think about things, and I think about science fact as it once became or was once science fiction. And I think about this world where me growing up as a kid, I think of myself in this room right now with you, all of you. I'm kind of a pioneer. And I remember growing up and thinking about science fiction. I remember looking at comic books as a kid. I remember watching cartoons as a kid where there was this character. His name was Dick Tracy. He used to talk into his wrist. And now suddenly I, Tom Crawford, I now talk into my wrist.
Today on Rethink What's Possible, we start to explore the fascinating horizon that is artificial intelligence and machine-based learning. Throughout the episode, we uncover its positive and negative effects on the world today, discuss what the future looks like, and learn how MSOE is working with students and partners to rethink what's possible. Today, I am joined by Dr. Sheila Ross, Professor and Chair of the Electrical Engineering and Computer Science Department, Dr. John Bacovey, Assistant Professor of MSOE's Electrical Engineering and Computer Science Department, and current MSOE Computer Science student, Ethan Hines. To lead things off, Dr. Ross sets the stage of where AI and machine-based learning is today, plus shines some light on one of my childhood questions. Are machines going to become self-aware and take over the world?
So, well, there is no question that AI, machine learning, they're getting to be everywhere, right? Every time I pick up the phone, I make a phone call. If I'm telling my voice assistant who I want to call, AI is working right there. So it's everywhere. And it's really been in use for, the type of AI machine learning that we do at MSOE. There's been an evolution. I would say in terms of solving problems, maybe that started around in the 90s is when this thing we call neural networks sort of started to get hot. And the complexity of the thinking of machines when they're making these decisions and learning has just increased over time. And so, sort of the technology back then, the technology now is a little bit different, but there are some things in common. So when we talk about machine learning, what we're talking about is a machine using data to make a decision. And that can be sort of, I would say, maybe simple binary decisions. You know, from when they first started using neural networks, they might say, okay, I'm going to try to use a machine to help me decide whether this person should get a loan or not. I'm going to train this machine to give me the best yes or no answer as to, do I think this person is going to be able to pay off their loan for the next three decades or not? And so the early setups for machine learning, basically what would happen is that you'd have a program where the computer had a lot of sort of space to almost like make notes, to store a lot of numbers. And it would start out by kind of just randomly guessing, that person is going to be okay, that person's not going to be okay. But the way that machine learning works is that we keep presenting the machine with things that really happened, okay, like real people who got loans and all the information that you have to give to the bank when you're going to get a loan, right? Just take all that information and in real life, did the person actually default on their loan or not default on their loan? And so we're like, hey, machine, you just randomly guessed at that, but here's what actually happened. And so then the machine says, all right, I'm going to change my notes. I'm going to change my numbers a little bit so that next time I'm going to be more likely to get the right answer for that particular loan applicant. And then a bank might be putting like all their loan applicants, maybe the last 30 years of applicant history through. And so the machine is looking and making changes every time to try to get the right answer more often. And that's sort of the basic idea of machine learning that's been around for the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, and to kind of build on top of that, really, what it takes to develop a machine learning model is a person. So fundamentally, I don't think that machines will ever take over the world because, sure, data science provides more automation to tasks, but it still takes someone to design and develop that task and define it.
Ultimately, the machines need us.
Absolutely.
Is that really, truly?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, and they're also only as good as the data you give them. And that's really a really big, important part of this. So if we think about the, you know, the bank using AI example, let's say they were running these models in 2005, okay, based on all of the things that had happened with mortgages, you know, prior to that. Well, pretty soon after that, the date, you know, if they're basing their decisions about, you know, who could, you know, get a mortgage and the conditions that were happening sort of before the big mortgage crisis that we had in the 2000s, it was based on past data and past situations that might not be really reflective of what's happening in the future. So they can't necessarily sort of like be, you know, psychics that are predicting the future. They're only as good as the data you gave them and only as unbiased as the data you gave them. So that's another good example with, you know, something like, you know, the history of loan applications. We know there's a lot of bias in there too. So they're going to have the same weaknesses and probably more weaknesses than the humans even who program them, because they can only work with the data that we give them.
So that dashes all my hopes that they become self-aware and take us over.
Yeah, Tom, I want to put your mind at ease. I don't think that Terminator is yet a documentary. I think it's still within sci-fi.
Now that we have the big question behind us and all of us have been put at ease, let's learn more about how AI and machine-based learning is already entwined in our daily lives and what we can expect to come in the future.
What are some examples of artificial intelligence in our everyday lives?
So the first one that I think of that is most impressive to me is a Tesla making its way down a highway without the driver having to ever interact with it. There's so much machine learning algorithms on that Tesla making judgments in real time from the cameras on the car to either merge into a different lane, slow down, speed up, and ultimately keep the driver safe. Another example that's probably more common is logging into any kind of streaming service. The recommendations you get, there's not actually an employee sitting there making you a playlist at Spotify. No, they're finding all kinds of commonalities between the lyrics and how it sounds, using these machine learning techniques to then find other songs that are kind of similar to what you listen to all the time and recommend those.
Is Alexa AI?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so a huge problem for me is when I get home at night and want to relax, I now have a plethora of streaming services available to me, and I log into one, and there's so many choices. I don't like making choices. Well, we can rely on machine learning and AI to help guide our choices and make them at least a little bit easier, even if they're still left up to us. So, for example, recommendation of the movies that I might like that I've never seen before based off of what I've seen previously and what other people like me who have seen things that I like previously. Those recommendation systems are all using that previous data to build these new suggestions for us.
And then another example is with social networks trying to show you things on your feed that you are interested in or maybe agree with. And this has actually become a bit of an issue, is where these models become so good that all they show you is what you agree with. They never show you what you don't agree with.
Turns into an echo chamber.
Yeah, turns into an echo chamber and just really creates a positive reinforcement loop. But I guess that's maybe a downside of artificial intelligence, maybe a space where we shouldn't. And really, that's where humans should come in and say, hey, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe we should try something else.
So, Ethan, that brings up a good point in that in our approach at MSOE, we want to give space and time to the ethics that are behind these new methods that are coming out and the use of data. And I know that we try to build into each of our courses, especially the courses that are focused on these methods, the ethics behind it and the ethical implications. In addition to that, we offer a course in senior year that is hosted by our humanities department, which just focuses directly on the ethics of AI and computers.
But no, the actual ethics behind what we're doing and making sure that we understand how what we're doing is going to be applied is something that's really focused on at MSOE and something that we even touched on in sophomore year One of the assignments I had to do was that I had to look for some kind of article that's talking about a failed solution of artificial intelligence, something that performed so well for what it was designed for, not technically the problem. And what I found was this article about facial recognition and how the data set, and kind of going back to her point of the model is only as good as the data you provide it, but the data set was extremely biased towards Caucasians because they developed it by taking pictures of people around the work office that they were in. And unfortunately, they didn't have a very diverse population. So it would only work with anyone that was not in a minority, unfortunately. And it really failed to perform at the essential function of facial recognition and really making sure that we remain ethically concerned with the data set and where it's coming from and what's in it is just humongous to the entire development process of artificial intelligence.
Something that we ask our students to do in our practicum course is to look at the project that they're working on and try to think of the ethical implications and maybe downfalls that they could run into through the development of this. So we've seen a number of examples through these industry projects in which the students come up with a report of things that they've considered, things that they've thought about, and they actually bring that up to their clients. And I've had a number of clients say, oh, we had never thought about this. This really brings to light something interesting that we need to consider before pursuing these endeavors.
What do you think AI and machine learning looks like in the next 5, 10, 20 years? And I open that up to all of you.
There's a lot of interesting problems kind of way beyond what we've sort of introduced right here during the conversation so far. There's, well, you know, image classification problems. So, you know, we just heard about, you know, a situation where you actually have like, so the input is an image. It's like actually, so if I have my phone and I take a picture, it actually became a whole ton of numbers. And that's what's going into the AI and it's trying to make a decision. Well, you know, if I look at a picture and I'm going to identify it, what are some of the things I look for? So getting the machine to know what to look for in an image, to be able to say what it is, to be able to say, okay, this area of the image is the cancerous part and this area is the non-cancerous part, and this area of image is the street that the car is supposed to be driving on, and this area is where the pedestrians are walking. So getting the machine to be able to look at the right features to be able to make those decisions, that's something called deep learning. And that's something that is sort of at the cutting edge of what neural networks are and machine learning in general is all about right now. And it is a very interesting sort of field and direction that things are going in.
Yeah, so the cutting edge of machine learning, deep learning as it stands right now is getting away from a labeled data set where we already know what each observation is and getting more into a unlabeled data set or unsupervised learning. So a really great example of this is a project that's done by Alphabet where they look at the game Go and they just feed the rules of the overall game to a model and then let this model play itself millions and millions and millions of times until it beats itself every single time. And now the strategies it develops, well, it's not influenced by humans whatsoever. It's something that's completely designed by itself. So we're removing that bias of humans from the data set of, you know, going in and labeling everything ourselves and letting the machine figure it out, figuring out the optimal path of winning the game. So what they ended up doing was so impressive because they invented this entirely new strategy for the game that even the top player couldn't beat. And then that game became a case study for all the top players around the world. And I think that contributions like that from artificial intelligence is where we'll go in the future, inventing things that are new instead of perfecting what we know.
I certainly can't predict the future, but I think we're going to see more and more adoption and usage of machine learning as we go on through here. And I think it's going to start blending even more seamlessly into our everyday lives and hopefully enhancing and making things easier for us rather than, you know, coming at us with red eyes and, you know, busting down the door and trying to you know, attack us, such as Terminator.
AI and machine-based learning is clearly here to stay and is playing a critical role in creating our future. At MSOE, everyone has encouraged to rethink what's possible as we can strive to shape the future for a better tomorrow. To learn more about MSOE's approach at AI, let's pick back up our conversation with Dr. Bacovi.
Dr. Bacovi, could you talk about MSOE's approach to teaching AI and why it's so important?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we're seeing industry move into this realm of big data and wanting to act on that. And what machine learning and AI and our approach here at MSOE is set up to do is give our students the tool set to actually go in and interact with that data appropriately and achieve those goals that these businesses are actually looking for. So at MSOE, we start off in really the sophomore year with some introductory courses to ideas around data science, around high-performance computing, around machine learning, so that we can get a general overview for our students to see what different aspects these things have for us and going into the future. And what we do in the junior year then is we really dive into the theory behind machine learning and how these algorithms are actually acting on the data, as Dr. Ross has pointed out. And we try to build this intuitive sense for what all this math is actually doing behind the scenes. And we start to think about data in a different way. We start to think about data in spaces and how data and observations that we have relate to one another and how these algorithms that we can use take advantage of those relationships. So we start building this foundation, and then we move on in junior year to a data science course in which we start to look at a broader perspective of data science and how we can use these algorithms in real-world problems.
Can you tell us about a project that you've been working on with the medical college, which just sounds so interesting?
Sure. So let me start off with giving a little preface for this. So in our junior year, we have classes that are about theory and about application of that theory. But towards the end of it, we actually have a class called Data Science Practicum. And this class puts students into groups in which they're partnered with industry partners or research partners. And these groups and their partners decide on a project at the beginning of the quarter. And this project spans the entire time. And it really brings the students into a real-world problem in which an industry partner has a problem that they need a solution for, or we're pursuing some kind of research question, in which the students then get their hands on data sets that aren't necessarily, like I was mentioning before, toy data sets or simple data sets, but they're real data sets that have real-world problems, real-world issues that the students then build skills to work through. And I think that really is at the heart of what we're training them and what they can expect to see once they go into an industry experience. And maybe Ethan can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, definitely. And that is what we see in industry experience from the internships that I've had with GE. And I can't really get too far into exactly what I do for that. But I can definitely say that MSOE models that very well. But our project working together in particular, the input to the overall project was a data set of it's blood cells within a kidney of a rat. And the output is a ranking system of the severity to which it's affected by cuts, bruises, lesions. And the overall goal of our project was to look at this data set and be able to train a model to do that ranking system autonomously, because previously it takes a highly trained individual to look at these images and have this subjective rating scale. So the biggest issue there is that it's just that, subjective. There's a whole lot of people with different meanings of what a 5 is, what a 3 is, what a 2 is. And in our paper, we talk a lot about how that actually affects the data, going back to Dr. Ross's comment about your model is only as good as the data is. But the overall project was trying to convert these images of blood cells to a ranking system of how bad it was to act as a precursor to look into kidney disease.
Yeah, to follow up on that. So a wonderful thing about computers is that they don't get tired, right? And they're able to look at, we were talking before about these descriptions of observations, these features. They're able to look at features and think, quote unquote, think about features far beyond what we're able to and what we have the capabilities of doing. And I think they really present an advantage for us, and we should see them as a tool that can help us process large amounts of data. Now, we have to have the correct problem. We have to have the correct setup and position ourselves well to ask the right questions to apply these algorithms for. But I think that they're really going to be seen as a boon for us.
We haven't properly met Ethan yet, but if you're like me, you probably realize that Ethan isn't your typical 21-year-old. So how did he get involved with AI and machine-based learning? You may have been surprised it all started back in high school when he was staring at a 1.2 GPA and an unknown future.
I got to ask you, the early days, the formative years, like when you were a senior in high school, I mean, why did you choose this career path?
So,
because it is a career path.
Honestly, me in high school was a completely different person. I finished my freshman year with a 1.2 GPA. I was not a great student at all, whatsoever.
How did you salvage this?
My sophomore year, I took my first engineering class, and I had an incredible teacher that could really see my passion for engineering and kind of hands-off, let me do what I want and dive further into the concepts. And it was a 3D modeling course, so instead of doing the part-by-part curriculum that everyone else in the class was doing, what I did instead was that I 3D modeled an entire car from scratch, 3D printed it, and then I got like this Pinewood Derby car that I could send down a track. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And soon as I was able to hit that passion, it was all uphill from there. Because I started taking AP courses back to back to back to back to back all the way through my senior year and raised my GPA up to barely a 3.0. And I got into MSOE because of it. And funny thing is, you asked about why I picked this career. I didn't know about me wanting to do this until literally the day I came to school. I changed my major from, I started as a, electrical engineer. And I thought back to my experience with AP Physics, where I was doing electricity and magnetism, and thought that I don't really like circuits, so I'm not going to like this career. I got to swap now before I waste my money. So I swapped to computer engineering because I was involved in my high school robotics team, where I designed all kinds of robots and coded them. And I wasn't really too far into the actual mechanical function of these robots, but I really liked programming them. I was trying to create a fully autonomous robot to complete the competitions versus the other teams that usually just have an autonomous period of a minute that usually their robots do nothing and then they take over with the controls. But my goal was to create something fully autonomous. So kind of back to the original question, I thought back to that and that experience and switched to computer engineering. And I realized just what I said there, that I don't really like the hardware concept of robots. So maybe that hardware and computer engineering and actually designing like GPUs and CPUs and how they interact across the computer isn't for me. So I swapped to software engineering because I really liked the software development and I really liked coding. And then during the thought process, and all this is still before my first day of school, it's over the summer, during my internship before my freshman year. But I talked with a lot of people during my recruitment process of what the actual definition of software engineering versus computer science is. And what I came down to is that software engineering is all about developing for a client. It's all about developing these inputs from a user. You get all this feedback from industry and then take that and run with it all the way to a product. And then you deliver it back to the client. Computer science, we do the same thing. We get ideas from industry, but instead of actually developing an application to apply that, we're at an intermediary step between the reception of an idea and then the software developers touching it. What we're doing is we're really playing around with those concepts and trying to develop new things to then develop to a software engineer to develop an application around it. And I personally love the opportunity to be creative and come up with new solutions. I think that computer science really applies to my creative side way more than I think a career in software engineering would. Because in software engineering, you're really just given a task and told to do it. You have very defined inputs and outputs. You don't really get a whole lot of creative freedom to develop something new. And really, computer scientists, well, you're a scientist. You're not an engineer. You're getting to the R&D aspect of the industry and doing all kinds of new things.
Found your niche.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you seriously found your niche.
Yeah, it took me a full summer before my first day of college to swap my major that many times. But I am extremely thankful that I did, because I have loved what I...
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't waste any money doing it. And I really do love my major and love what I do, because now I'm working for GE Healthcare in the healthcare space. And it took me a while to actually figure out to do the healthcare space. That's a different story, and I can get into that too. But the opportunity to actually impact lives and save people's lives by writing code, that to me is an extremely rewarding career and something that I can get down with for the rest of my life.
You seem really passionate about that.
Yeah, yeah. My first internship after my freshman year was with the company called Ontario Systems, and it was my first software development role, and it was just that, software development. And that's also the reason why I didn't go back, was because I was hired as a software engineer. I wasn't hired as a computer scientist. So I got all these different user stories and bug fixes and whatnot, but what I didn't really know about the company going in is that the product I got put on was a debt collection software. So the developers, yeah, right, a debt collection software. The developers didn't like maintaining it, because the code that was written for this product was aged, and it really wasn't very well maintained. And it was all written in a language that's so old that, I kid you not, I was writing code for DOS terminals. I had to ask a senior developer why there were two read calls right next to each other. He told me that the first read call is to spin a tape to the position where the data is, and the second read call is to actually read in the data. That's not documented anywhere. How am I supposed to know that? But overall, the whole experience of working on a debt collection software just it didn't match with my ethics. Like it didn't really match with who I was. And I mean, I was offered a full-time position at the end of my internship, and they wanted me to drop out of college. And I said no, because I looked at the work and said, I don't like that at all. I don't like what I'm doing here. And the big takeaway from that is that I need to be in a career where I'm helping people. And really what happened from that full-time offer is that I got brought on as a part-time continuation throughout the school year in kind of a co-op situation. And I ended up quitting it around Christmas, because I simply came to that conclusion of, I don't like ethically what I'm doing here. And I actually quit it and took a humongous pay cut to go to tutoring for MSOE. But sure, I took that pay cut, but I'm actually helping people hands-on. I'm looking at students that were just like me in high school and failing literally everything they're touching and not able to pass a test to save their life. And then I turned them from this person that can't really pass a test to coming back with me with A's on everything. And that is by far the most rewarding type of career that I've ever been in, is helping people. So then I thought about healthcare and how that's literally saving lives with every line of code you write. And now I can ethically agree with everything I'm doing and everything that my career stands for. I really do love what I do, and I think that that is such an important aspect. And I think that MSOE really provides you the opportunity to get all these experiences and test all the waters and kind of learn the lessons along the way, especially with their small class size and the mentorship from not only your peers and our tutoring system, but also your professors and the faculty there, being able to kind of guide you in the direction.
It has always been great to get the perspective on how a student views their educational journey. Ethan was able to find his purpose on what drives him over time, but I want to quickly turn it over to Dr. Ross and Dr. Bacovey, who talk about the importance of hands-on learning and echoes this notion that the carrot at the end of the stick is really about the impact you can have on changing lives.
I think, you know, there are many, many people that need that goal, need to see the impact of what they're doing, need to see that they're doing something practical, that it's going to have an impact on people's lives in order to achieve, right? So it's, you know, if you're just sitting in class and you're doing these math problems, you don't really know why, somebody said you have to because this is what you need to go to college, that's not necessarily going to motivate people to achieve. So something that we do at MSOE, and I mostly taught in the electrical engineering program at MSOE, is that we will intentionally, all the way through the curriculum, including right in the beginning, including the freshman year, you are doing things in your major. You're seeing what the impact of being an electrical engineer, a computer scientist, will be. So you have, you know, the goal is right there in front of you, and it actually helps you do better. It helps you achieve. Engineering has a reputation for just being about equations and being about going to science class and being in a lab. And so at MSOE, we get you into it and you can see exactly what it is. And, you know, those misconceptions hopefully can go away, because engineering is about creating. It's about improving people's lives through what you create. And we try to put that front and center. From the time that you begin at MSOE to when you're leaving, and you really are able to create things that make people's lives better.
Yeah, I think the overall kind of approach to MSOE of being so hands-on to kind of build on top of that is what really draws me to stick with MSOE and trying to really appreciate what I create versus other programs. You know, you'll dive into theoretics and never really understand why. What are you doing? What are you creating? Versus the projects I work on, it's very clear cut and defined. What's the larger impact of this? Like with my project with Dr. Pacovi, it was very clear cut and defined from day one after meeting with him and meeting with the other people he's worked with on this project before us, of understanding the larger impact in the healthcare space of why we're doing this and how we're going to try and add to that space.
To build off of that, I like to say, well, I'm no mathematician myself. not that there's anything wrong with being a mathematician, but it's hard, certainly during my schooling years, it's hard for me to see an equation and just understand the relationships that it's representing. It's not until you have that application that you are able to put in real numbers in there, that you're able to see the effect of those and see the consequences of that, that I think the beauty of those really start to shine through. That it's describing these relationships that you're able to then use. So we have all of our students in computer science take calculus 1 through 4, and also linear algebra. And those are great classes. They provide the foundation. You need that understanding in to be able to proceed. But it's in our later classes where we actually start using those as tools, and that we're able to see the power of them besides just putting numbers into an equation and expecting something out on the other side. And I think that's where this excitement comes from. And I know that's certainly what drives me in this field in particular. I was actually able to see the application of these algorithms. I was able to see the use of gradients in helping a computer find values that it can then use and come to some conclusion for. And while I knew that those were things beforehand, it wasn't until we got to that section that we're actually able to use it for our own benefit, to be creative with these things and actually have some effect on the data. And that's what, to a large degree, really drives me and really interested me in this field as a whole.
Before we wrap up today, it wouldn't have been a complete episode without acknowledging the very desirable Rosie. So let's send it back to Ethan to hear more about the magical powers of this Rosie.
Yeah, so Rosie is this beautiful girl that walks across campus all the time, and all the CSs are crushing all over her. You know, looking through Dierks Hall in the windows, flowers everywhere. Oh my gosh, such beauty. But it's actually the supercomputer that they built into the new computer science hall. And thankful to the gigantic donation by Dwight Dierks to actually build this hall, they're able to provide us undergraduates with a supercomputer to play around with, which is crazy to me to think, because usually it's the graduate students that are playing around with it and being able to actually run the algorithms that need a supercomputer. But I guess I'll start by describing my experiences by saying that most of the stuff that I do would take years to run on my personal laptop. Actual years. And I wouldn't be able to have that hands-on experience of training models and actually running them through concept to full-on model development without having a supercomputer to do that. Instead, I'd only be reading about it in a paper or looking over code that does it. Versus actually troubleshooting a model and going back and forth through hundreds of iterations and trying to get a model that works. So my experience with Rosie, I'm able to log in from anywhere whenever I want and queue a job. I'm able to run whatever code, as long as it's within the fair use of Rosie to accomplish whatever goal I need for my school project. And that
is... So no mining of Bitcoin.
Yeah, no mining of Bitcoin. I will say that I believe this has been shut down, so I can mention this, but there was a Minecraft server that was hosted on Rosie for a time, which was hilarious because when you load it in, it had like this giant Rosie sign, and it was one of the guys in my class that did it. But
I feel like that's appropriate.
Yeah.
I feel like it should be, but it got shut down, so who knows? Who knows who made that call? But
it's very important. It's been an important part of what you do and your education, this computer.
Yes, definitely. Without Rosie, I would not have been able to have the same experience in my program. I would not have been able to have hands-on model training and development experience at all, because really I would need the resources to run those models. Otherwise, it would take literal years to run on my school laptop.
From how AI and computer-based learning surrounds our daily lives to the cutting-edge research MSOE and the Medical College of Wisconsin are undertaking, today's episode captured the essence of what these amazing technologies can do for us humans. And hey, I feel a little bit better that robots won't be taking over the world anytime soon, considering that we are in good hands with bright young leaders who are enabling these technologies. If you enjoyed this episode, please share, subscribe, or review. It helps others like you find our podcast. Until next time, I'm Tom Crawford, reminding you to rethink what's possible.